So joining us now is our first guest, Jeff Tuff. Jeff is a principal at Doblin and leader of Deloitte's design and innovation consulting arm, which is the Doblin Group. Jeff, welcome to Innovation Navigation.
Hi, Dave. Thanks. Thanks for having me on.
So I'm familiar with three different, but I see very interlinked pieces of work that you and Doblin are associated with. First is the 10 types of innovation framework, which argues that we need to move beyond just product or services innovation to look at, you know, business model innovation, distribution channel innovation, customer experience innovation, business process innovation. And then second, you did a piece in Harvard Business Review recently, which argued that as you move away from products and services, products and markets, rather, that you know, not only does the risk level rise, but also the organizational challenges multiply. And finally, you just released this report earlier this month that found that, not surprisingly, given your other two pieces of work, that while executives feel that innovation is important, they're not doing much beyond product and service innovation. First, you know, I'm trying to summarize your entire life's work in three sentences. What did I miss? And what else would you add to that?
I'd like to think there's lots other involved in life's work, which is probably not relevant for this show. But I think actually all three pieces that you've brought up here, not surprisingly, are interrelated. And I actually think the business confidence report that we released recently is probably the right starting place, because it's starting to bring to life some data behind what we've seen with our clients and seen in the market for the past couple of decades. But things really are shifting, and shifting more dramatically over the course of the last few years, given the rate of technological change. So
in that business confidence report, you found that companies really are struggling to adopt new types of innovation. Why do you think that's happening?
Well, so there's actually a really interesting dichotomy in the report. So the first headline from the report is that 70% of the executives that we surveyed, so we talked to 300 CXOs, so anyone with a CEO, CMOs, what have you, and then another 300 CXOs in waiting, people who are going to take on those jobs afterwards. So a sample of 600 of the most senior people from some of the biggest companies around the U.S., and 70% of them are absolutely convinced that they're going to outperform the competition in the coming decade.
Okay.
That's probably not going to happen. It's interesting to see that level of confidence. But the most interesting part of the report, from my perspective, is when you compare that 70% of executives who are highly confident that they'll beat the competition, and then you compare it to what they're actually doing, there's a massive gap. So while 70% are confident that they'll outperform the competition, only 50% say that they're really doing anything to encourage innovation. And this is at the same time that almost all of them, 90% of them, report that they are concerned that the rate of technological change is leading to a skills gap in their company. So even though they've got high confidence, they know they're probably going to be facing a brain drain in the coming years, and they're doing hardly anything to keep their talent and to protect them and to give them new tools to go out and look at innovation differently.
And your earlier work, your firm's earlier work about the 10 types of innovation says that, you know, just coming up with a new product it's really hard in most industries to get any kind of sustained competitive advantage from innovation in that core area, that it's only when you explore other types of innovation that you might be able to get a jump on the competition.
Yeah, and we've been seeing this for years. It came out again in the business confidence report when we asked the executives where they're focusing their innovation guns these days. It continues to be largely around products and services. We're increasingly seeing some focus on customer experience, which I think is a positive sign and a shift in the right direction. But as you made reference to, we've identified 10 levers and 10 ways of creating value from innovation. Those are only two of them. Focusing on products and focusing on customer experience are only two of them. And actually, they're probably the most frequent ones that companies turn to. So there is massive amounts of opportunity for companies to look at these other levers, things like how they can get paid for innovation differently, or the partnerships that they strike to create value from innovation, or the channels that they use. And it's only when companies start to systematically look at all of those levers as sources of value from innovation that they're going to be able to actually outperform their competitors, rather than simply hope and believe that they will.
So what is one of the more undervalued types of innovation that you found in your work?
Well, so I would say the one that is often talked about but rarely realized is around profit model. So literally how a company makes its money and how it charges for the services it provides. I think it's something that a lot of companies aspire to go and shift and to work with in a different way, but very few are able to achieve it because it's so linked into everything else that they do. It's interesting to look at the examples of companies or industries that are disrupted or in the midst of getting disrupted when someone does come along with a different profit model. So that one of my favorite examples, and it's been well talked about recently, is what Dollar Shave Club and now a variety of Dollar Shave Club imitators have been able to do to disrupt the razor industry that had for many, many years relied on the now cliched razors and blades model. And Dollar Shave Club, because it came in with a subscription model, was able to come in and do something completely different, not necessarily just because they were able to allow consumers to buy their razors under subscription, but because they were able to, through that subscription and the automatic delivery, increase the switch-out rate of razors. So that's an example of having started with a business model or a profit model innovation that actually had ripple effects throughout that entire industry.
What gets in the way of companies doing that? I mean, it seems like we've been talking about business model innovation, and there's the business model canvas. You know, we've talked about that on this show, and there's tools out there, and there's some awareness, but why do companies struggle with it?
Two reasons, really. The first is siloism. So it's very difficult to bring a new innovation to market where you're working across those 10 types of innovation with multiple different levers, unless you can get different functions and different departments within a company to work together effectively. So it's one thing to go to your R&D group and ask them to come up with a great new product and then throw it over the wall to the commercial system to get out to market. It's an entirely different thing to get R&D to work with finance, to work with marketing and sales, to think about how we're actually going to shift everything that we're doing to bring something new to market. And in the face of having to get that, I hate to say it, but it's a reality of most big companies in our country today. But in the face of the organizational dynamics necessary to get that sort of collaboration going, a lot of people just back down to the here and now. So that's one reason. The second reason, and probably the main sticking point for a lot of the companies we looked at in this business confidence survey, why they're not doing something more dramatic, is the tyranny of delivering the quarter. It is so incredibly difficult for companies to look beyond delivering the numbers in the short term and actually do it, and to actually do something different. And I we've been seeing this with our clients for years and years now, that they have great ambition. They have all of the tools and the knowledge necessary to go out and do something different on the subject of innovation or to bring a new innovation to market. But when push comes to shove, and they need to make a decision between getting the incremental margin to deliver the quarter or reinvesting that to go and bring something out two or three or four quarters down the road, 9 or 10 times out of 10, they'll opt for delivering the quarter.
Jeff, I'm getting really depressed. We're talking with Jeff Toff. He's the leader of Deloitte's Design and Innovation Consulting Practice, the Doblin Group. And if you have a question about how to innovate in more and better ways, give us a call at 844-WHARTON. That's 844-942-7866. I'll tell you why I'm getting depressed, Jeff. I think of Doblin, and I've never heard this, but I credit you with the metaphor of playing the innovation piano, which is that, you know, there's lots of different keys on the piano that we can play: the product key, the service key, the customer experience key, the business model key, the supply chain key, et cetera. We can innovate in lots of different ways. And I always think of that metaphor as having two meanings. One is that we should explore playing different keys, and the second is that we should play chords, not keys, that multiple complementary innovations are more powerful than any individual innovation. What you're saying, though, is that, number one, it's hard for companies to even try to play a different key, that the tyranny of the quarter makes it really tough to take the time to experiment and learn a new type of innovation. Second, your latest report says that we don't really have the talent to play a different key. And third, that even if we did have the talent, trying to coordinate it across the organizational silos so we could, you know, make a harmonious chord, a set of really complementary innovations that reinforce each other, is very, very difficult. So Has anybody done this?
Well, so they haven't. First of all, I love the extension of the metaphor. My colleague Larry Keeley has often talked about using the 10 types to play chords. But the reality is, as you point out, it's difficult to learn to play the piano. It's difficult to even be able to pick out the keys, let alone play those chords. But, and this is where I think actually the optimism might come through, once you learn how to do it, and once you can feel the patterns, it should become more second nature. And at some point, you should be able to play, not necessarily by memory, but by instinct. And what we're increasingly seeing is that big corporates are trying to do that. I mean, truth be told, if you look at the places where we've seen the best chords being played or the best mixes of types coming to market on a single platform, it's usually being done in smaller companies or in startups where they don't have the legacy of an old business model or the legacy of some conventional wisdom of the way things need to be done holding them back. The good news here, and by the way, I'm sorry if I started your Tuesday morning by depressing you. I actually am largely optimistic and convinced that we're going to end up in a good place given all of this. But the good news is it's no longer negotiable whether big corporates learn how to innovate better and learn to play those chords better.
Well, help me out. I mean, who has done this? Who's made that transformation? Or maybe, you know, start with a company that does it well. Maybe that's the easier question. And then get to how we convert from a company that just does kind of incrementally better versions of products to really playing chords in the piano.
Yeah. Well, so I'd name a few, and some of these are well-known innovators, but when you start to look at them through the lens of the 10 types, it perhaps becomes a little bit clearer what they've done. I know one of your favorite examples, given the book you've written, is Lego. I think Lego is a fantastic example of a company that learned how to play chords and has learned how to switch up playing those chords over time, whether it's looking at ways to expand their product system, which is one type of innovation, or looking at the various different movie tie-ins that they have done with their products over time using network innovation, or looking at customer experience and brand as a way of engaging their customers differently outside of simply playing with the blocks. That's a company that really has, whether they've done it using the 10 types or not, I don't know, but that's a company that really has learned how to play different chords at different points in time and keep up a sustained growth stream from that, and you can probably talk even more about that than I can.
My sense is that the link to you guys is that there's a Danish consulting firm named Red Associates that drew quite strongly from the work of Doblin, and Red Associates was quite involved in Lego's transformation. So it's kind of a, you know, you get the assist.
Yeah, good.
Well, the hockey assist, at least.
Right. So Lego's a good example. I think what Nestlé did with Nespresso and how they moved to extend their business model to include retail experience and online convenience, a different way of engaging their consumers, a different business model, different profit model, not only extending into selling machines, but also looking at ways that they could charge for coffee differently than they had historically. I think that's an interesting example of a company that maybe they haven't been quite as agile as Lego in trying other chords over time, but their original chord in setting up the Nespresso system was certainly very successful.
I don't know if you're familiar with the case study of that, but there's a fascinating case study about Nespresso because they actually they were invented quite a while ago, and they were trapped underneath their Nescafe brand, which is, of course, you know, pretty crappy instant coffee.
Right.
And within that, they just atrophied. Nothing happened for a decade. And it was only when they formed a separate business unit did they start playing other keys. Did they have the freedom to play other keys? Before, it was really just they were constrained by their corporate management to just come out with, you know, capsules and coffee makers that use those capsules. And it was only when they got their own business unit could they explore the cafes and the great website and the subscription models and everything else that they started doing that made them so successful.
Yeah, so you're making a fantastic point, Dave, and I'm glad you went there. You made reference to the article we wrote a few years ago for HBR about managing innovation portfolios, and I won't go into the detail behind that study, but the study was primarily looking at what is the right balance of innovation to have in your core versus stretching into adjacencies versus getting into transformational spaces. And as we've been out talking to executives about that study and what works and what doesn't work and how to actually make it real, what we're discovering is there is a line, and I can't unfortunately draw it over the radio, but there's a line that separates half of that chart, half of that ambition matrix from the other. And the line separates the known and knowable world, meaning the part of the market that you know or that you can go and survey effectively and get real answers from customers on what you should do, from the unknown and, in some cases, unknowable world. And if you want to play in the unknown, you have to go and set up a separate business structure. You have to have different incentives. You need to have different metrics and usually different talent involved in going to explore that, which is what Nespresso was able to do when they had that breakthrough. And I think increasingly what we're finding is that corporates are discovering that they can, if they can take some portion of their innovation team, whether it's a centralized innovation team or some people picked from each of their various different businesses, and put them on the edge, to refer to one of my colleagues, John Hagel, who's done a lot of work around scaling edges, and put them on the edge, it doesn't have to cost a lot of money, but you find the right people with the right passion to go and pursue these things, that has a much higher likelihood of getting to a good outcome quickly.
So as we move to the edge, does what happens to risk and reward and everything else?
Well, the conventional wisdom would say your risk skyrockets and you need to say things like, you know, don't be afraid to fail and no idea is a bad idea. But actually, there's a ton of really bad ideas and people shouldn't set out to be okay with failure. But they just need to accept that if they're going to fail, they should fail in the right way and they should fail quickly and do it without exposing the company to a lot of that risk. So what edge-oriented teams need to be doing is drawing more from the world of design and the lessons of how designers do their work than from traditional businesses. So I would encourage any company that's thinking of setting up an edge business to separate it from whatever systems you have in place already. If you've got an edge business trying to run through your stagehead system, it's not going to work. If you've got an edge business that's populated with people who have grown up within the company or who have come out of a very traditional business, and that's the mindset that they're bringing to the table, it's probably not going to work either. So I won't bore you with the details of exactly what metrics you need to put in place and what product development systems are more effective out there, but the summary point is think like designers or be designers or use designers. Don't use traditional business people.
I agree with you, Jeff. I think failure is overrated. We're talking with Jeff Tuff. He's a principal at Deloitte, and he's leader of Deloitte's consulting practice, the innovation consulting practice, the Doblin Group. And if you have a question about how to innovate better, give us a call at 844-WHARTON. That's 844-942-7866. You know, the whole issue of risk, though, is something that I've been trying to put together, Jeff. Let me give you an example and help me think through this. We talked to USAA, the insurance company, and they've expanded. They started out as auto insurance for military personnel, and they went into lots of other kinds of insurance and went into banking. And that seems like it'd be fairly low risk, right? I mean, starting up a bank in the U.S., acquiring a bank really is what they did, seems like it'd be fairly low risk. We had on Mick Simonelli, and we talked about how they're experimenting with new applications of airborne drone technology, which seems like a higher risk, right? I mean, that's a technology that's still being proven out, being applied in some very new way a new application. In their case, they wanted to fly drones over houses and cars that have been hit by, you know, tornadoes or hurricanes to view their settlement. Now, it seems like drones in a new application would be a very kind of high risk, high reward, whereas starting up a bank in the U.S. would be fairly low risk. But it seems to me that USAA is actually the opposite situation, right? That them going into banking means that they need to provide a seamless experience to their customers. You acquire a bank, you've got to do that huge data integration challenge. You've got to make it so that if somebody calls up and says, hey, I just got married, then the bank account adjusts, the auto insurance adjusts, the life insurance adjusts, the home insurance adjusts, you know, and all those things come together in a seamless way. That involves some major changes to the core of your business, whereas replacing somebody who drives out to the site of a flood or a tornado and checks whether the house is flattened, you know, if you want to replace that with a drone that flies overhead, you just work with a couple partners, and the first partner that can do that reliably, you swap them in and you change that way of doing it. What do you think of that? I haven't put this together, but it seems like the way you'd evaluate risk for a complementary innovation is different than you'd evaluate it for a core innovation.
No, I think that's exactly right. The whole topic of risk and the way it gets discussed in big companies gets muddied because no one's, at least in my experience, people aren't clear about what the nature of risk is that they're talking about. They talk about risk, the inherent risk in making an innovation move as being about, for example, investing in the drone or getting into drone technology when we haven't worked with that drone technology before. And so much of the conversation is about the risk in the innovation that what people are not talking about and not laying on the table is what they're actually worried about is risk to their core business. They're not most of the time worried about the incremental investment it will take to go and try something new. They're concerned about the knock-on effect to their industry and to their business if they get it right. And so it's historically, it's actually been generally okay for companies to look at getting into a new space and saying, you know what, no, that's too risky. We don't want to invest in it. We can focus on our core business because things haven't changed that quickly. Things have changed in a kind of linear fashion, and they have for decades, up until probably 3 or 4 years ago when we've started to see so many technologies that are, because they sit on the power of computing, that are now on exponential curves. So if we look at, for example, what's happening with drone technology over the course of the next 5 to 10 years, it is going to render some industries and some ways of doing business completely unrecognizable. And so it's no longer okay for companies to simply consider, does it make sense for us to invest in a drone technology and say, nah, we can't because there's too much risk in that investment. They have to be doing that. They have to be looking at how they can leverage additive manufacturing or nanotechnology or whatever the exponential technology is that's relevant for their industry. So I applaud what USAA is doing, and you know, even as recently as last week, or maybe it was even this week, then the headlines were talking about what GM is doing with Lyft and with Cruise autonomous driving. That's a great example of a very traditional company that understands they're under existential threat, and they're going to continue to run their core business for some time, but they're trying to do something fundamentally different that actually does seem to be in line with what consumers want and the way that the industry is going. So I applaud USAA, GM, and lots of companies like them who are at least trying to do something different to shift their business model.
But the barrier, it seems like, is not so much technological. With GM and Lyft and with USAA and Precision Hawk, who is their drone partner, it's more the internal barriers. How do you, as a consulting practice, help companies get past that internal barrier to taking on new types of innovation?
We go and do it and drive growth. There's no you can't reason with traditional businesses and with people who have grown up in traditional businesses about why it's important to go and do something different. And I don't mean to sound pejorative in that. I'm not trying to put down people who protect their core business. That's what they're meant to do. For most companies, that is what's yielding cash today. And absolutely, every company needs to protect its core business model in order to invest in what's to come in the future. But you're never going to be able to get any organization to shift until you actually demonstrate that the company is capable of doing something that is going to lead to real growth in the market. And so most of the time what we're doing with our clients is saying, look, let the core business run. We will go off with that edge team, and we'll go and create something new. And we'll get it into market, and we'll demonstrate that you can make money from it. And once that is demonstrated and we can show that there's a way that we can get a new business model to market without disrupting the core business, then adoption takes off. But I can tell you, the other way around, simply trying to reason with folks about why they need to cut down some of the investment in the core to go and invest in explorations elsewhere ahead of something actually having worked, just doesn't work.
But Jeff, you've got the luxury of being pretty expensive. And what I mean by that is that, you know, so by the time a company has hired your firm and brought in the team and organized their side of the team, that's got top management attention because there's a price tag attached to it. I'm thinking about, you know, poor Snogs, who's, you know, trying to do something within his part of the business. You know, he's responsible for the next product. He knows that he's got to do something more than a product to win in the market. What advice would you have for Snogs?
I don't even know how to say Snog's name, but hopefully that will work. But pick one or two passionate people and go and do it. And I, sadly, I'd like to say that we continue to be able to simply be expensive and go and do things for our clients, but we're being held accountable to the same standard as Schnogs and his team, which is that we have to deliver growth. So a lot of the time now we're going out and co-investing with our clients to demonstrate that this can be done. But Schnogs, whether it's Schnogs or our team, there is no replacement for people who are passionate about an idea to go and get it done, because that is not only a much better predictor of success, but it's, if you have the right people on the team, and of course you need to consider their skill sets. Ideally, you'd be working with people who do actually have some design background on the team. But if you've got the right people, they'll figure out a way to solve a problem without it costing tons of money. And in fact, I made reference before to some of John Hagel's work in the Center for the Edge. He's actually recommended that you starve teams on the edge, that you don't give them a lot of resources, and instead you hold them accountable for getting something done, an early stage prototype, and they figure out a way.
Yeah, right. I mean, thinking about the USAA example again, it didn't cost them anything to go find a drone partner and test it out. I mean, that's not a big expensive thing. Having a lot of funds might actually have hurt their ability, because they might have started investing in drones themselves and, you know, tried to do it all themselves, which would have actually slowed things down. We've been talking with Jeff Tuff. He's a principal at Deloitte. He's the leader of Deloitte's design and innovation consulting practice, the Doblin Group. Jeff, thanks very much for coming on Innovation Navigation.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me, Dave.